rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it looks like Death Squad John beat a man. Yes, indeed, good old Death Squad John Negroponte is going to be the director of all intelligence for the United States. Just as we find out that one of the judges involved in deep-sixing a decision, well, involved in the decision to throw a couple of journalists in jail for refusing to reveal their sources, which spreads this basically, terror across the journalistic world. You can actually go to prison for refusing to reveal your sources under this administration, and two are now facing it. One from the New York Times, one from Time Magazine. We discover that one of the judges who put this thing together, I'll give you a little more detail on this as we go along, was also the judge who stopped the investigation into Iran-Contra at the point where it began to look like it would point to George Herbert Walker Bush having cut a deal with the Iranians to hold the hostages so that Ronald Reagan could beat Jimmy Carter in the election of 1980. It's all about payback here. And, of course, Negroponte then working for the Reagan-Bush administration. Well, here's the setup. Today, President Bush, this, news just announced in the last hour or so, President Bush announced or named John Negroponte, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He, by the way, being the guy who sold the U.N. on the idea that they had to pass a resolution to stop Saddam Hussein from having weapons of mass destruction and set up this marvelous war that we have. Then he was nominated to be the ambassador to Iraq, where we are building an embassy capable of housing a staff of 1,000. May have something to do with Negroponte's tendency to build empires when he was in Tegucigalpa, when he was ambassador to Nicaragua. He was, well, we'll get into that. He tenfold increase. Yeah, excuse me, was it El Salvador? A tenfold increase in the staff, the CIA staff down there. Anyhow, announcing the move at the White House, Bush said Negroponte understands global intelligence because he's had a long career in foreign service. Yeah. Let's take a look at that career, in fact. In fact, it took almost a half a year. I mean, there was this six-month delay in Congress because of criticism of, he was U.S. ambassador to Honduras, of his record as the U.S. ambassador to Honduras from 1981 to 85. And the Council on Hemispheric Affairs has a nice summary of this. Now, this, of course, was published a few months ago, published April 27th, actually a year ago, just almost a year ago, when Negroponte was coming forward as the Baghdad, Baghdad John. But it's still a pretty good summary. You can find it on the COHA.org website, news release. The central fact, they note, of the Negroponte story is that he misled Congress when some of its members attempted to question him about his complicity in helping to cover up his knowledge and direct personal involvement in the training, equipping, and distracting attention from the heinous acts of Battalion 316. Battalion 316, the Honduran Death Squad, which at the time of Negroponte's residence in Honduras was responsible for the murder of almost 200 that we know of. Of almost 200 Honduran dissidents opposed to their country being used as a, quote, unsinkable aircraft carrier, this is what Negroponte called it, in the U.S.-backed Contra war against Nicaragua's leftist Sandinistas, a government elected by its people, by the way, democratically. Negroponte replaced Jack Binns. Jimmy Carter had this guy named Jack Binns in there as the ambassador to Honduras. And in 1980, that was the election year. You know, Reagan didn't come into power until 81, even though 80 was the election year. So during that last year, the Jack Binns was the ambassador to Honduras. He kept speaking out about the, quote, mounting evidence of major human rights violations occurring in that country against political dissidents who dared to speak out against the growing involvement of Honduras in the secret Contra war against the Sandinista Nicaraguan government. Yes, this was happening under the Carter administration as well. I mean, this goes back away. This was the CIA was running this thing. And the former director of the CIA was George Herbert Walker Bush, just about to become vice president of the United States. Interesting coincidence. A big part of this story, notes the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, a big part of this story is the flawed annual human rights reports. Now, every year, U.S. embassies around the world are required by the Foreign Assistance Act. This is a law that was passed by Congress, the Foreign Assistance Act. Every ambassador has to sign off on a report prepared by their embassy, which talks about the human rights situation in the country to which they are the ambassador, in the country in which they are serving. When it came to Honduras, this report was significantly expurgated, as in, you know, like pieces stripped out of it, first in Tegucigalpa by Negroponte, and then once again after it reached Washington by then Assistant Secretary of State for Humanitarian Affairs, the infamous Elliot Abrams. This operation subverted the law, and Abrams eventually confessed to his role in the Iran-Contra affair, but was later pardoned by the first President Bush. But he was the guy, Abrams was the point guy, who kept the information about Negroponte from coming out. And then Abrams, for that crime, got pardoned. They go on to say, there is no question that Negroponte and the rest of the senior embassy personnel must have known about the disappearances and tortures of Honduran. Now, they were called leftists at the time. I suppose you could call them nationalists. You might even call them conservatives. Depending on your definition of the word, they were Hondurans who felt that Honduras should not be used by a foreign nation as the staging ground for an illegal war against the democratically elected government of a neighboring nation. What would you call people in the United States who objected to Canada organizing a secret army on the Texas border to attack and disrupt the government of Mexico? If Americans in Texas and Arizona were to speak out against the Canadian Secret Service secretly setting up death squads that were running operations out of Arizona and Texas, flying over into Mexico and capturing people and torturing them and bringing them back to Arizona to torture them and murder them, and Americans spoke out, would you call them leftists? Would you call them patriots? Would you call them conservatives? What would you call them? Well, the Bush-Reagan administration called them leftists. Anyhow, some of the most widely distributed newspapers in the country carried in one year, just in the year 1982, when Negroponte was there, he was the ambassador to Honduras, when he claimed, oh, I had no idea. No idea. 318 stories in that one year were carried in the major newspapers about disappearances and tortures of Honduran citizens who objected to Negroponte and the CIA using Honduras as a staging ground for the illegal, what was ultimately deemed by Congress and by United States courts as an illegal war, as ultimately what came to be known as Reagan and Bush's illegal war, the CIA's illegal war, against the Honduran, against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Negroponte also had direct contact, they note, with General Gustavo Alvarez Martinez, by then the chief of the Honduran Armed Forces and the secret head of guess who? Yes, the death squad goon bunch known as Battalion 316. They go on to note Negroponte's objective in Honduras was eerily familiar to the, similar, to the Bush administration's present goal in Iraq. The U.S. government, again, is attempting to implement a democratic format in a country that has not yet chosen to do it on its own and not necessarily by using democratic means. He's kind of an ends justifies the means guy. In fact, I'd say that's a bit of an understatement. General Luis Alonso de Escua Elivar, a former Honduran death squad commander, said that he was willing to spill the beans on Negroponte and, in fact, was going to do so. He was going to tell the whole story. This was a former death squad commander in Honduras, worked for Negroponte. He told the United States Congress he was willing to come up and testify. He was going to prove that Death Squad John was in on this. In fact, he would do it to the media unless his family was allowed to remain in the United States. So what did the Reagan administration do? I'm sorry, what did the Bush, George W. Bush administration do? Now, this guy was going to testify when Negroponte was put up for U.S. ambassador. They pulled his visa. Yes, send him back home. They'll know how to handle him there. Despite an abundance of reporters, scholars, and former governmental officials who have publicly raised questions about Negroponte's record, no public witnesses were invited to try to establish before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that Negroponte was not qualified for his U.N. post. None. And during his stint in Tegucigalpa, Negroponte expanded the embassy's staff size tenfold, and it became home to the largest CIA deployment in all of Latin America. Death Squad John, now the head of all intelligence for the United States. Is it starting to sound like the SS to you? It's getting strange here, folks. It's getting real strange. The old creepy, strange guys are coming back out of the woodwork. And in fact, something similar going on right now with regard to Iran and Mohammed al-Baradei. It's sort of the reverse. Al-Baradei is trying to tell the truth. The United States is trying to get him thrown out of his job. And wait till you hear what Hillary Clinton's up to today. Right after this, 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here.
Attention, Tom Hartman, listen.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year.
I think it happened today.
Blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before. Where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. And there's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run.
You tell them, Jackson Brown. Well, welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Apropos of that little bit of bumper music from Jackson Brown, I would like to share with you a former president of the United States, ladies and gentlemen, Herbert Hoover.
And here we can examine one of the methods of power politics, and that is propaganda. During the World War, propaganda was first developed into an actual weapon no less potent than the killing of men. When peoples and governments weigh the sacrifice of their sons, Then truth and honesty and tolerance and justice are thrown to the winds if a lie will serve better.
The President of the United States, Herbert Hoover, on propaganda to promote war. The use of propaganda. He was speaking, of course, of Woodrow Wilson. What Woodrow Wilson did to get us into World War I. That's a whole other argument. But I tell you, there are some Republicans who have some integrity and some consistency in their belief structure. They're few and far between these days. In fact, I can't think of one right at this moment. Maybe. Well, I don't know. I was going to say maybe John McCain, but even the guy. Well, Olympia Snowe. Okay, I'll give you Olympia Snowe, and I'll give you Voinovich. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, by the way, if you'd like to call in. TomHartmann.com, the website, if you want to drop into our chat room. Lots of interesting conversation. This quote from Herbert Hoover, it's just so appropriate for today. It's only 20 seconds. I have to share it with you one more time. Just consider this.
And here we can examine one of the methods of power politics, and that is propaganda. During the World War, propaganda was first developed into an actual weapon no less potent than the killing of men. When peoples and governments weigh the sacrifice of their sons, then truth and honesty and tolerance and justice are thrown to the winds if a lie will serve better.
1-866-889-8894. Rick in Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
How are you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Maybe you could include Ron Paul of Texas there in the Honest Republicans.
Yeah, well, he's I've never talked with Ron Paul. I've read good things about him. He's more of a libertarian. I know that there's many areas where I disagree with him, but he is at least, as far as I can tell, he's at least philosophically consistent. And
speaking
and
of which,
I respect that.
Did you read Buzzflash yesterday?
Buzzflash is a pretty big site. I'm not
right,
sure.
Right. Well, the article about the journalist that was working for, I guess, something called Talon.
Talon News Service, yes. Good old Jeff Gannon, a.k.a. Mr. Gunker, or whatever his name is, the gay prostitute that...
That's my point.
Good and buddies with Scotty McClellan and...
Sean Hannity was fawning all over him, and Sean Hannity claimed to be so outraged when Bill Clinton had a consensual heterosexual relationship with a woman, he was just outraged. I mean, talking about inconsistencies, how do you figure these guys?
Well, I'm really not an advocate of outing gay people who don't want to be outed, but here we've got you've got Karl Rove, who's never been married, and there's all these rumors about him out there now, and you've got Ken Melman, the head of the RNC, and he's actually been outed by a couple of gay sites, and it's like, is there this gay hating gay mafia within the Republican Party? I mean, it's just very, very strange. And as I said, I as a strong and ardent advocate of gay rights and of not outing gay people unless they want to be. But I think the rules are a little different when it's people who make a living trashing gay people and are being hypocrites like Jeff Gannon. Thanks for the call, Rick. 29 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
When all we had to worry about was the button being pushed? It's almost like they were the good times. We had basically one big country that didn't like us. Amazing. Now we've managed to upset the entire world. And we're pushing it even farther here now. Mohammed al-Baradei, he's the head of the United Nations agency that checks out nuclear activity in various nation states around the world. The International Atomic Energy Association, or committee, or whatever it's called, the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency. There we go. He's originally Egyptian. The guy's actually a nuclear scientist and a politician, very competent one. And now the U.S. is trying to get him pushed out of his job. We are trying to get this guy fired from the U.N. Why? Well, first of all, we've got a grudge. Back when he was inspecting Iraq, he said, hey, you know, in Iraq, I've been around Iraq, and I don't see any weapons of mass destruction. There's no evidence of any nuclear stuff here. At least, you know, other than the stuff that we already have under lock and seal. And that was just yellowcake uranium left over from, you know, back 20, 30 years earlier. It has now been looted, of course. We have no idea where it went. Might show up in Manhattan someday, God forbid. Why was it looted? Well, because we had to defend the oil ministry. That was the important thing, remember? I mean, that was the absolute critical, 100% most important event when we went in there. George Bush, when he declared the war on Iraq, I mean, this is setting the priorities. He turned to the camera. I mean, you remember that? This was like 2 hours before they started bombing Baghdad. He turns to the camera and he says, "And now I'd like to speak to the people of Iraq." And I'm sitting there expecting him to say something like, you know, our young men and women, our soldiers are the same as yours. There are young men and women. Your young men and women are in your military. They're really all just kids, you know. Let's try to have as few of them die as possible. Why don't you just lay down your arms? We have, you know, we're the most powerful military force in the world. Just, you know, give it up. I was expecting something like that. I mean, it would seem to make sense. You know, it could have even been couched in Bush terms. We are going to crush you, so, you know, resistance is futile. But no, he had a slightly different message. He turned to the Iraqi people and said,
your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, everybody in Iraq went, oh, that's what you care about.
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
Yeah. Okay, now we've got it. And, of course, you know, what did George say to us here in America?
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
He is. So anyhow, we're trying to push out al-Baradei. First of all, good old Mohammed al-Baradei had the audacity to point out that there were no nuclear weapons in Iraq. And now, heaven forbid, this guy, now he is saying, you know, we've been in there inspecting the program in Iran, and they did have the capacity to enrich uranium. But Iran has cut a deal with England, France, and Germany, and now Russia, that they will stop enriching uranium and just go ahead with a peaceful nuclear reactor in exchange for Europe selling them stuff they want. I'm not talking about nuclear weapon stuff. I'm talking about, you know, consumer goods, water purification stuff. You know, they want trade. So the Europeans have worked out this deal with the Iranians, and they went to them and they said, you know, we'd really rather you didn't make any nuclear weapons. We know you could do it, but we'd really rather you didn't do it. And let's work this thing out so that the UN and Mohammed al-Baradei can go in and he can inspect this. He can inspect what you're up to. And we can keep track of it, and we can make sure that you're actually not violating the rules. And they stopped, you know, I mean, yeah, they're 6 months away from making a weapon, sure. But they've stopped. And according to the British and British intelligence, the French and French intelligence, the Germans and German intelligence, the Russians and Russian intelligence, and the United Nations and Mohammed el-Baradei. Well, we can't do much about the British, the French, the Russians, and the Germans except ignore them. El-Baradei, however, because he works for the UN, where we have considerable clout, we can get his butt tossed out on the pavement. So here's the story from, of all places, the Washington Times. Headlines, U.S. still pushing to oust el-Baradei. The United States still is hoping to remove Mohammed el-Baradei as the Egyptian head of the UN Atomic International Atomic Energy Agency as it prepares for a showdown over Iran's nuclear program, a senior Bush administration official said. This person who chose not to speak on the record, not to give their name, but is a senior administration official, said, quote, it cannot be good for an organization, that being the UN, of course, when its biggest contributor, that being the United States, and its director general, that being Mohammed el-Baradei, in terms of the nuclear stuff, are at odds with each other. Washington views him as soft on Iran's ruling clerics, notes this article in the Washington Times, and suspects he was behind the embarrassing leak about missing explosives in Iraq. Oh. He embarrassed us. Oh, can't have that. That is something this administration, we will not tolerate. No embarrassment for George Bush. You cannot embarrass George Bush. You embarrass George Bush, he will make sure that your wife loses her job. Even if CIA agents die, even if a counterterrorism operation operating in a dozen different countries is destroyed, you do not embarrass George Bush. U.S. officials are trying to gain support, notes the Washington Times, for a no-confidence vote, possibly at the next IAEA meeting on February 28th. Note your calendars. However, as of this moment, no other country is willing to sign on. The Washington Times goes on to note, Britain, France, and Germany reached an agreement with Tehran in December under which the Iranians, who say their nuclear program is civil, not military, agreed to suspend uranium enrichment in return for trade accords and technical assistance. Then we go back to this unnamed official in Washington, D.C., dancing to the tune of George W. The official warned the European nations that their opposition to referring Iran to the Security Council, quote, will not be forgotten in Washington. In other words, we're now threatening Britain, France, and Germany. We're now threatening them for not going along with us about firing el-Baradei. The official warned the European nations that their opposition to referring Iran to the Security Council, quote, will not be forgotten in Washington, adding, quote, next time we hear their views on the importance of the UN, we will be reviewing previous comments by Europe on Iran. You know, they can threaten Democrats in Congress, and they do it all the time, and they're successful more often than not. And they can certainly threaten recalcitrant Republicans, and they're very successful at that. Be interesting to see if they're successful at threatening England, France, and Germany. In the midst of this now, Iran and Syria have gone beyond just saying, well, okay, we're friends. The Syrian Prime Minister, Naji al-Otari, and the Iranian Vice President, Mohammad Reza Aref, have issued a joint statement. This is from the Iranian Vice President. We are ready to help Syria on all grounds to confront threats. On all grounds. I encourage you to go back and look, you know, plug world. I haven't done this, so I can't guarantee what the results will be, but I think it's a pretty safe bet. Plug World War One, Austro-Hungarian Empire, Archduke Ferdinand and Sarajevo into Google. You might want to toss in treaties or commitments. In fact, this from the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. I am quoting from the BBC, the fourth paragraph in an article headlined, Iran to Aid Syria Against Threats. One, two, three, four, I'm sorry, the fifth paragraph. And I quote, to point to Syria. Now, they're talking about this bombing in Lebanon. Syria has 14,000 troops in Lebanon. To point to Syria in a terrorist act that aims at destabilizing both Syria and Lebanon is truly like blaming the United States for 9/11. End quote. This is the British Broadcasting Company. Ah, another bastion of liberalism, yes. The Russian defense ministry now has confirmed it's discussing the selling of missiles to Syria. Again, I encourage you to plug Archduke Ferdinand and World War One into Google. People need to learn history. I'm telling you. Syrian expatriate affairs minister Bouthiana Saaben said she was baffled by the U.S. reaction to the killing. She said Mr. Harari, this is the guy who was assassinated, had been a great ally to Syria, and his death was, quote, a scandal against Syria and against Lebanon. An editorial in the Los Angeles Times titled The Devil We Know in Lebanon. Opening sentence, this yesterday's paper. If Syria was involved in any way in the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, most likely, it was a remarkably stupid move. They go on to point out Syria sent its troops to Lebanon in 1976 in an effort to quell a murderous conflict among Lebanon's complex array of religious and ethnic groups. In 1989, with the aid of Saudi Arabia and Harari, the guy who was assassinated, an accord was reached that helped end the conflict while leaving Lebanon largely under Syrian control. They point out Lebanon has not exactly been Switzerland since then, and we all have to acknowledge this. Hezbollah, which is known for their terrorist attacks against Israel, with the backing of Syria, has used the country as a base to launch terrorist attacks, one of the main reasons the U.S. has been targeting Damascus. Yet compared to the bloody horrors, now I'm reading from the Los Angeles Times editorial, yet, compared with the bloody horrors of the Civil War period, today's Lebanon is almost an Eden, with Beirut's waterfront transformed from a bullet-ridden shell to a Tony business and tourist enclave. They point out about 10% of the population of Lebanon is Palestinian refugees. You're going to have problems when you have a situation like that. They say Syria's eventual withdrawal may be inevitable, but it will be an occasion fraught with danger. In this part of the world, you really have to be careful what you wish for. Pulling Syria out of Lebanon, it might, on the one hand, in the most simplistic of thinking, it might cause, you know, an end to support for Hezbollah and an end to attacks on Israel. That would be great. On the other hand, it might triple the power that they have. I mean, I don't know. I can't tell you. But what I can tell you is that when external countries, like not even part of the region, start messing around and, well, we're seeing it right now. 1-866-889-894 Kodak in Durham, North Carolina on the line. Hey, Kodak, how you doing today?
I'm fine. How you doing today, Tom?
Great. What's up?
Overall, looking at the entire picture, it just seems that nothing just seems to make sense. We have Republicans on one hand fighting tooth and nail to keep our airways free of profanity, while yet they're not well, the journalist, guy frozen as a journalist, can just ease right into the White House. I don't really think the issue is about his homosexuality or him being a prostitute. I think the real issue still is about the way in which he has gained access to the White House,
Yeah.
without credibility.
Yeah.
Which all gets back to the issue of how can the Democratic Party regain control, or at least get their message out.
Yeah, well, the Democratic Party has to start standing up and speaking the truth. And Hillary Clinton, by the way, is leading this thing. I was going to get into this, and well, I will right after this break. I'll tell you all about it. Good point, Kodak, and they've got to start speaking out. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
In a world where everybody's falling apart,
except here. Yeah, see, that's the thing. We've got to circle the wagons, pull a tribe together. Those of us who believe in democracy in America, not in single party rule, not in managed stagecraft by the White House, whether it's by a Republican or a Democratic administration, but those of us who believe in open government, those of us who believe in democracy, we got to stick together. Okay, here's the deal. Josh Middledorf and Steve Freeman have published this article in These Times. Josh Middledorf is a statistics professor at Temple University. Caveat, I've corresponded with this guy. I can't, you know, it's not like he's some good friend of mine, but I know him, and we've corresponded. And they have done a study of the Mitofsky Edison stuff. And, here, just a couple of quick quotes. This from this piece that they wrote. Notably, Mitofsky and Edison unsuccessfully tried to explain away the fact that, according to their data, only in precincts that used old-fashioned hand-counted paper ballots did the official count and the exit polls fall within the normal sampling margin of error. Further, the data that are underplayed in their report provide support for the hypothesis that the election of 2004 was stolen. And they go on and on through this. I mean, we'll get back to this before the day is out. But they just lay it out. They just lay it out. That the exit polls were right. There's an 8 million vote difference. And they're suggesting the election was stolen. So now Hillary Clinton, presumably, you know, thinking about running for president, says, we don't want that to happen again. So today, Clinton and Barbara Boxer, in a noble effort, are introducing the Count Every Vote Act. And this is a huge deal. And I was amazed how hard it was to find anything about this on any news reports anywhere. The bill mandates that there be voter-verified paper ballots, that the ballot be the official ballot for purposes of a recount, that there be uniform standard for provisional ballots, that if people like the secretaries of state get involved in politics, or if owners and managers of senior voting machine manufacturers get involved in politics, they can go to jail for up to a year. That there are no excuse absentee ballots that require states to allow citizens to register on the day of election. That turn election day into a federal holiday. I mean, just this is it. This is it. They're introducing it today, the Count Every Vote Act. Let's hope it gets a little more press than I suspect it will, because we need this, regardless of where it came from.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the second hour of our Thursday program, which every week is when we go beyond politics, beyond the issues of the day, beyond what you think you know, beyond what you may think you don't know, but you might need to know what you don't even know that you need to know. Maybe what you know isn't right. Maybe...
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Is it possible that everything you know is wrong? I am pleased to have with me a partner in crime here, George Lynn. He's also a psychotherapist. George Lynn is a licensed mental health counselor from Bellevue, Washington, who has pioneered the use of psychotherapy for adults and children with neuropsychological issues. He's the author of three popular books on parenting children with extreme behavior challenges, including Parenting Your ADD Child, Survival Strategies for Parenting the Child with Bipolar Disorder, and his most recent work, Genius, Nurturing the Spirit of the Wild, Odd, and Oppositional Child. And those of you who listen regularly know I've written a bunch of books on ADHD, and I've known George for years, and I can tell you there is nobody that I have ever met in my whole entire life who is more knowledgeable about how to work with kids who are off the scale on the wild, extreme end of behavior than George Lynn. George, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
George, you note that children with dystrophic behavior are required if society's going to survive. What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, what I'm talking about is the fact that systems don't, you know, nothing changes unless it's disturbed. And the kids that I work with and are disturbers. And when they're little kids, their disturbance is not, you know, well thought of, not well received in school. But I guess what history shows us is when they grow up, the very things that disturb school teachers and school principals and bureaucracies are the things that result in society moving forward.
Lots
of examples of that. It's really kind of difficult, in fact, to think of read of any major societal advancement that didn't involve these kind of children.
Somebody who as a child would have been classified as a disturbed child, like Thomas Paine getting thrown out of school when he was a kid, Franklin getting thrown out of school when he was a kid.
Einstein not getting into grad school, you know, these kinds of things.
Right, yeah.
There's you can just go right down the list.
Give me a list here. Toss a few out. And those are that's the low-hanging fruit.
Sure, okay. Well, if you're using... AC current, you've got Nikola Tesla, who was probably one of the greatest inventors of all time. Most likely, when you read his life, he was autistic, possibly, or Asperger's syndrome. And his life also, he did psychotic things. He you know, matching his great inventions was, you know, he was extremely reclusive. He died alone, surrounded by pigeons. He was had a great mind, but a mind that was really out of sync with the rest of culture.
Yeah, his social skills were kind of close to zero.
Most likely ripped off by another, you know, great inventor, Edison, for his invention of AC power. Yeah. Edison himself, as we all know, you know, from the books that have been written about him, was most likely either kind of raving ADHD or possibly a manic depressive. Mm-hmm. Guy slept one hour a night, didn't change his clothes, etc. And we know what he gave us.
Yeah. Have you read Diagnosing Jefferson by Norm Legend?
Yes, I have indeed.
Here we got Thomas Jefferson as most likely or probably an Asperger's kid.
Yes. I love that. I love that. All the stories about Jefferson and about how fastidious he was. One story about when the British were coming up the driveway to hang him from the nearest tree after he did his work on the Declaration of Independence. He fussed with his art collection almost into the last minute. Just got out the back door, jumped on his horse, and away he went.
Yeah.
But
this kind of
At the very least, he had obsessive compulsive disorder.
Oh yes, I understand he wore, you know, he had the sensory integration problems. People with Asperger's syndrome have a difficult time with the feeling of clothes on their body. We don't hear about, you know, Jefferson giving speeches as president in his bedroom slippers, but this is the kind of thing that he did.
He did, yeah. He would answer the front door of the White House in his bedroom slippers.
Yeah.
Very often in his dressing clothes. So, people thought,
you know,
he was a servant.
We've got, how about Samuel Johnson, great obsessive compulsive, you know, the author of the dictionary, dictionary of the English language. We've got, oh, George O'Keefe, the great painter, spent time in psychiatric hospitals. Emily Dickinson, very possibly a bipolar also in that same category. You know, we can go on and on and on. And it's just really difficult to find anybody that sort of had a well-adjusted life that really moved us, you know, in the quantum jumps.
They really produced change in society, particularly positive change. Although there have also, you could probably say the same thing about Napoleon and Hitler.
Oh, you could,
you know,
yes.
Negative change as well. So, which highlights the importance of people reading your book and taking seriously your message, because these kinds of folks, these agents of change, these disruptive kids, they are going to be agents of change one way or another. And a lot of it depends on how they're on their self-image and how they're brought up. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Tom. Well, you know, the book is it's about genius. It's genius exclamation point, and I'm not referring to IQ measured genius. I'm referring to the way genius is classically defined by the Greeks and Romans, which is as a guiding spirit, and or in the myth of the genie in the bottle, i.e., you know, the boy finds the bottle at the base of the tree, rubs the bottle, the genie comes out, the genie threatens to kill the boy makes a deal with the genie to get the genie back into the bottle, and then the result is the genie eventually giving the boy gifts of healing and prosperity. And it's a great myth, a great metaphor for what I see genius is in terms of these disturbing kids, and that is when they're little and their brains and minds and bodies are unformed, they have this energy on board. It wants out. It wants, if they're ADD, ADHD, it wants to explore. If they're bipolar, it wants to go deep. If they're Asperger's, it wants to invent. But it's a rough and raw energy. And so depending on how caregivers treat that energy, whether they can contain it and nurture a child, it may go one way or the other. We all know that the dismal statistics about how many of these kids end up in the penal system. And to some extent, we know about their success also. But I see very much a kid's genius is kind of like a plant that can grow. It can be, you know, twisted this way or that way. But it's what we have when they're little kids is the substance in raw form. And it needs to be trained and tempered.
So we have a parent who has a child who, for example, refuses to go to school.
Yeah.
Let's take it even farther than that. Refuses to go to school, threatens to injure themselves, threatens to injure others, yells and screams, fights with their parents, throws things, breaks things, smashes things, you know, engages in not just antisocial behavior, but antisocial behavior within the context of the family, as well as, you know, externally directed behavior.
Yeah.
This is increasingly common now in our society. Or at least the stories of this are increasingly common. Whether it's growing in incidence or whether it's simply growing in reporting, I'm curious about. Well, first of all, what's your take on whether it's growing in incidence or it's growing in reporting? And then I'd like to ask you, what's a parent to do?
Yeah, I think it's. One thing for sure, it's growing in reporting. I mean, just with the internet and with people talking to each other and, you know, the information explosion, obviously these things are, people are finding out more about them than they did when you or I were kids. But I think there's a very good possibility also that environmental, two things about the environment. One just in the, just straight across environmental pollution and the possibility you know, kids are experiencing damage in utero, you know, very
like the link between mercury and Asperger's or autism.
there's all kinds of, you know, things that can be doing this, the level of smog and the nitrates, you know, pollutants that the people ingest. Okay, so that's probably one part of it in terms of the environmental causation of it. And another part of it in terms of the environmental causation of it is just the fact that we're more isolated from nature. And I think this is part of it. The more artificial, the more the faster culture gets, the less the breakdown of the family, you know, the less.
Right. I was just going to say we're more isolated from family, too. Kids aren't raised by their grandparents like they used
right.
to be.
And there isn't the community.
Yeah.
And the human brain seems to do poorly with this. It tends to destabilize. My theory about a lot of these kids that I work with, and you just described a child that would probably be diagnosed as possibly manic, depressive, or something like this.
Certainly oppositional.
My theory about that is that they have a vulnerability, and that some kids are just born with that vulnerability, and that vulnerability is also part and parcel of their genius. But that vulnerability needs to be recognized, and it needs to be contained in a certain way. You know, there are different ways in my book. I talk about, you know, essentially six strategies for helping kids that have that kind of very disturbing and potentially self-destructive behavior, helping them grow up, you know, helping them get through their teens, and in fact, maybe their 20s, so they can get to a place of, you know, giving the world their gifts.
Yeah.
What I see in my practice is, even taking a kid like you just described, I've worked with these kidlets from the time they're like 7 or 8, and now in my practice, you know, I started this in the early 90s, so I'm beginning to see some of them in their late teens, and they're doing just fine, actually.
Yeah, If you can just get them through that difficult period. We're speaking with George Lynn. He's the author of Genius! And, George, we only have 1 minute left. What's the, other than going out and buying your book right now and reading it, what's the best advice you'd give parents who are facing, some sort of a diagnosis or what, you know, somebody who just says, you know, lock them up or, you know, throw some drugs at them or something?
The best advice is to understand what's going on with their child, and because that's the point that's missed, and that usually involves networking with other parents, being very careful about the professionals that they involve themselves with.
But find professionals who see this as a gift rather than as a curse, who are willing to see the humanity in the child rather than just the behavior.
Exactly, Tom.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And you and I both know, I mean, we both speak at the same conferences. There's a startling few such professionals out there. It's a real sad thing in our culture that we are increasingly seeing these kids as throwaway kids and an industry that sees them as a profit opportunity.
Yeah.
A brilliant book you've written, George. Genius! And the subtitle, Nurturing the Spirit of the Wild, Odd, and Oppositional Child, George Lynn, L-Y-N-N. And is there a website, George, real quick?
There is indeed. Genius-Childspirit.com.
Genius-Childspirit.com. Thanks, George.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back in the forests of confusion. Tom Hartman here with you, routing around for the truffles of truth. Thank you, Dan. And yes, you know, our exceptional children can be a gift, or sometimes it can be a gift that goes wrong, and that's why it's so important that we recognize it and treat them well, because we don't want them to end up like this.
There's an old saying in Tennessee. I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee. That says, "Fool me once, shame on you.
Yeah. Anyhow, welcome back. Interesting research on why Chinese students do better in school than Caucasian kids. They just specifically compared Chinese and Caucasian kids. That's what they were looking at. In fact, the study was done in Greece. And it's published in the March-April issue of Intelligence. And they found that it had to do with the fact that these kids are exposed to an alphabet at a young age, an alphabet that has 2,500 pictorial symbols. Here's the summary from Science News, February 12th. Learning to read 2,500 pictorial symbols as Chinese students do in grade school yields a 5-point advantage on IQ tests compared to the scores of Westerners whose languages are based on alphabets, according to a new analysis of mental capabilities of Greek and Chinese children. Dimitrian, this is Andreas Dimitrian of the University of Cyprus in Nicosia, a psychologist. He says, our findings support the assumption that reading and writing systems are powerful methods for influencing the development of mental abilities and perhaps brain growth in individuals and in cultures. The new finding, which appears in the March-April issue Intelligence, undermines the controversial proposal of an innate intelligence advantage for Asians as compared with whites. The study says, quote, what have previously been argued to be differences based on biological qualities can be explained by differences in experience that often vary with racial or cultural membership. Fascinating. Fascinating. Science marches on. 1-866-889-8894. We can talk about this stuff. We can get back into politics. There's so much going on today. Whatever you would like. Xavier in Santa Cruz on the line. Hey, Xavier, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, Tom. Yeah, that last segment really resonated with me.
Were you one of those disruptive kids, Xavier?
In spades.
I can tell you I was.
Yeah.
Still am.
Still are.
Still am.
I tell you, support is the thing that you need. There's two points I wanted to make here. One is that, you know, I had to reparent myself. I had a really hard life, and a lot of people, they can go either way, and it's really important to get support for people like this. The other point I wanted to make is shamans, shawpersons.
Yeah.
In different cultures, you know, that's a very similar thing. I'm wondering if you've looked into this.
I have. I have met indigenous shamans on three continents. People,
they're shunned by society.
Well, not only that, they were all, in my opinion, schizophrenic. Every single one of them. The three that I've met, they were classic schizophrenics.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know people in our culture who are classified as schizophrenic, and they have these ideas that that chips have been implanted in their skin.
Well, I think that to borrow a phrase from William Blake, they see through the crack between William Blake said the smallest requisite touch, the veil between the skeins of time and space will part.
Yeah, they might skew it with things that sound crazy, but I do think they have their finger on something. I don't know if it's psychic or if it's just attention to subtler things that the rest of us are trained not to see anymore.
No, I'll tell you, you cannot lie to a bird or a schizophrenic. They know what you are thinking. I'm serious. They know what you are thinking. You can phony it up with a dog or a cat and with people, but you can't do it with schizophrenics or birds. You definitely can't do it with shaman because they're trained schizophrenics. I agree with you, Xavier. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 29 minutes past the hour. And now for...
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Tell it, Jackson Brown. Welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. You can drop by our website, tomhartman.com. Of course, not to be confused with the other website, hotprogressivestud.com. I'm sorry. Bad Jeff Gannon joke. We need to sober up here. Victoria Jones, will you help us out?
I'll do my best.
Okay, welcome.
Do my best.
Welcome, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service with our daily report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria, what's happening there in the nation's capital?
Well, the main news, I'm sure you've already talked about it, the president has nominated John Negroponte to be the first national director of intelligence.
Yeah, good old Death Squad John.
Right. Well, exactly. And I imagine that will come up in his confirmation hearing because it is a job that does have to be confirmed by the Senate, even though it's not a cabinet post.
Yeah.
And whether this guy is maybe getting a reward for doing Iraq, you know, that he gets this plum job, who knows? I mean, you couldn't pay me money to do this job.
Yeah, it's going to be a difficult job.
It's awful.
Yeah. On the other hand, he's going to have more power than probably any other human being in the United States.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Look at how Herbert Hoover, just running the FBI, blackmailed three presidents in a row.
It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
And he has that all powerful power of the purse, which is everything in Washington.
Yeah.
Even it seems over Donald Rumsfeld.
Oh, that's a scary thought.
Well, it's at least from Rummy's point of view.
Yeah, an interesting thought. So, one of the things I found interesting was that there was a fellow, a member of the Nicaraguan death squads, who was willing in 2001 when Negroponte was being nominated for U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He came forward and said that he wanted to testify before the Senate and was going to spill the beans on Negroponte's involvement with the death squads. If his family was not allowed to stay in the United States, and boom, the Bush administration pulled his visa and deported him. So
really,
yeah. So there may, yeah. I don't have his name right here in front of me. I gave it in the first hour, and that part of the stack is now in another part of the room. But it may not be that there's a lot of people left to tell the stories of what happened.
That's one of the problems with death squads and things, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, I have read about it, but I don't know the detail. You know, I don't know the extent, if any, of this man's involvement. So I would like to know. If he was not involved, I'd like to know that, too, because it's the kind of thing that sticks to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully it'll come out. And some of these questions can be answered. As you say, it's possible that he's gotten a bad rep. And if that's the case, I'd like to see it cleared up. If not, I'd like to know the truth of what's going on. Anything else happening in Washington we should know about?
Well, that's the main thing. Donald Rumsfeld is up on Capitol Hill again today. He was there yesterday testifying before House Committee and a bit of the Senate, I think, basically talking about the supplemental in the budget and trying to explain to the senators and House members exactly why it is that Iraq and Social Security, although that's not his bailiwick, why they aren't actually in the budget, and how much they're going to need, and related questions. And so it's quite lively because the Senate committees certainly take their work seriously in terms of that they have a pretty good time, and you've got some fairly lively personalities. So he is there along with General Myers. It's one of those times in Washington shortly after the budget comes out where everybody has to go up. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was up talking in depth yesterday about foreign policy issues and money and foreign aid. We had Porter Goss and head of the CIA and Mueller, head of the FBI. They were up, as you know. So it's that kind of a week. Everybody's saying this is what we need and this is why.
Yeah, yeah. And really the bottom line here is he's underneath it all. He's trying to pitch for or rationalize the largest Pentagon budget in the history of the United States, however you slice it. And he wants more money. And he's a salesman.
You know, I never heard of a defense secretary who didn't.
Yeah, well, there's that point. That's well said. Well said. Yes, thank you for the reality check. You're absolutely right. Victoria Jones from the Talk Radio News Service, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you, and
thank
we will
you.
Talk with you tomorrow.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye now. It is 23 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Interesting stuff at Ohio State University happening. Let me tell you about that after we hear from Alice in Northern California on the line. Hey, Alice, 1-866-889-8894, by the way, our telephone number. Hey, Alice.
Yes?
Welcome to the program.
I'm very proud of Hillary.
Yes.
For the count, every vote, Bill.
Isn't that marvelous what she's doing?
Oh, I tell you, I like that woman. I've got a beautiful picture of her.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know,
I really liked Clinton. I could forgive him for a lot of things.
Yeah.
And because he did a real good job. He so much better than what we got now.
Yeah, as many complaints as I have about Bill Clinton and his trade policies and some of his getting in bed with corporation policies, he was the best, certainly the best Republican president we've ever had, and one of the better Democratic presidents.
Yeah, that's right.
He wasn't altogether bad. And that's high praise from me.
You know what I'm hoping?
What's
I'm
that?
Hoping that Hillary will be our first lady president.
Well, I think
I'm 91, but I won't be around for it. But I'm hoping.
Well, you may be around for it. I certainly hope you are. And
yeah.
And I think it would be a marvelous thing for the United States to have a lady president. And I have to say, I haven't yet made up my mind about Hillary. I'm sure if it was her against a Republican, I would vote for her. I just don't know enough about where she's at politically as her own political animal, separate from her husband. And that's what she's staking out right now. She's mm-hmm. defining who she is. And I suspect over the next couple of years, we're going to learn a lot about.
Oh, yeah, she's going to be in the public eye more than ever.
Yeah, no doubt mm-hmm. about it. And so,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Alice. Good to hear from mm-hmm. you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. 20 minutes before the hour. Conservatives in the Ohio State Senate are considering a bill. Get this. In fact, before I tell you about this, let's just consider for a moment, what is the purpose of a university? There are really two schools of thought on this. There is the technical school of thought, which is that the purpose of a university, really, you should say the purpose of a college in this context, is to teach a particular set of skills. You want to produce a good surgeon? You send them through medical school and you have them learn surgery at the best surgical college. You want to produce a good electrical engineer? You teach them at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. You want to produce a good, fill in the blank. Right? So there's this one school of thought that the purpose of higher education is to develop, inculcate and develop a very specific skill set. And then there's the larger one, the older concept that long predates the idea of just a simple education, the idea of the lyceum, of university, of universitad, that suggests, and this is where the phrase liberal arts education comes from, that suggests that the purpose of a university is to produce a well-rounded individual who has a specific skill set and a broad understanding of all those things that make up our culture so that she or he can become a productive, successful, positive member of our society. That they understand enough about ancient history that they can see the patterns of history when they begin to repeat. That they understand enough about modern history that they can understand the genesis of current situations. That they understand enough about literature that they have some insight into the human soul and the nature and of humanity. That they understand enough about poetry that they know how words can touch and heal. That they know enough about art, that they understand how it's possible to express in many different ways meaning and story and information and mood and feeling with color or with shape and no words at all. That they have some training in public discussion. Perhaps in theater, perhaps in debate, that they've learned a musical instrument or have some exposure to music, that they understand the exquisite mathematical nature of the works of Mozart and Bach and Beethoven, and as well understand the extraordinary creativity brought to an underlying mathematical structure to what we call jazz, for example. not to just, you know, not to just arbitrarily pick out two, but two of my favorites. That they have a perhaps more important than anything else, that they understand the unpopular ideas in our culture as well as the popular ideas. That the unpopular ideas are quite clear, you know, that they have had an exposure to, not just an exposure to, but really the ability to challenge the unpopular ideas. To understand, you know, where did they come from? How did this come about? What is the basis of this? Where does this come? How do other people think? John Kennedy had a well-rounded education. John Kennedy said, and I quote, "We are not afraid to entrust the American people with unpleasant facts, foreign ideas, alien philosophies, and competitive values." That is, values that compete with what we consider to be our values. "For a nation," John Kennedy said, "that is afraid to let its people judge the truth and falsehood in an open market is a nation that is afraid of its own people." Now, that was the ideal of education that has held in the United States for 230 years, that goes back to ancient Greece and before that, but I mean really had its peak in ancient Greece. Now, given that background and this marvelous quote, I just have to, one more time, John Kennedy, "We are not afraid to entrust the American people with unpleasant facts, foreign ideas, alien philosophies, and competitive values for a nation that is afraid to let its people judge the truth and falsehood in an open market is a nation that is afraid of its people." And I would add, is a nation that is repressive of its people. And so here now we have this story reported to us by the American Progress Action Fund. From the Progress Report. "Conservatives in the Ohio State Senate are considering a bill that would prohibit public and private college professors from introducing, quote, controversial matter, end quote, into classrooms and shift oversight of college courses and content from state governments to state governments and courts. They want to put the politicians in charge of university." This comes out of the writings and stirrings up of right-wing activist David Horowitz, who himself has no academic credentials, apparently. Ohio Senate Bill 24, introduced late last month by State Senator Larry Mumper, a Republican. What a surprise. Who says it is necessary because, he says, and I quote, 80% of college professors are Democrats, liberals, or socialists, or card-carrying communists, end quote, who attempt to indoctrinate students. When asked how he came to that conclusion, Mumper said he had been investigating the issue for months. But when asked to cite just one instance when he had heard of an Ohio student who said she was discriminated against because she had supported Bush for president, that was it. When asked to cite just one incident, he said, "I heard of an Ohio student who said she was discriminated against because she supported Bush for president." He added that anti-American professors are a threat to young people, and said he didn't think it was right for college campuses to teach students things their parents might disagree with. No more controversy, in college. Political science professor at Ohio Wesleyan said the law would stifle debate. Yeah, that's the point of it. And Kenyon College President S. Georgia Nugent called Horowitz's thinking a severe threat to academic freedom. David Horowitz, the guy behind all this, the driving force behind the so-called movement for academic freedom in Ohio and other states, has a distinguished history of intellectual defamation, historical inaccuracy, and political bullying, according to the Progress Report. He has freely compared American liberals to Islamic terrorists, slandered the Democratic Party and John Kerry for criticizing the war in Iraq, and made a habit out of accusing his detractors of racism. This is incredible. What is happening here in America? I'm telling you, the Stalinists are taking over 10 minutes before the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. So have the liberals taken over the campuses? I mean, you know, this was one of the reasons why Ronald Reagan stopped funding for free education in California, and the California educational system was because those nasty students were protesting the Vietnam War, you know, and the free speech movement in Berkeley and all that. Put an end to that. Anyhow, here, the Progress Report, over the past 30 years, they say, actually, it has reversed. The right wing has built a powerful campus machine. A dozen right-wing institutions now spend $38 million annually pushing their agenda to college students. Conservative foundations channel tens of millions more for academic programs, which buff an intellectual sheen over conservative ideology. Groups like Young America's Foundation, which spent more than $10 million on campuses in 2003, have no progressive or liberal counterpart. The ultra-conservative Leadership Institute, boasting prestigious graduates like Jeff Gannon, claims it has trained more than 40,000 college students to become conservative leaders since 1979. Amazing. 1-866-889-8894. Peter in New York on the line. Hey, Peter.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
Yeah, there's just so much going on. It's kind of like so much to be outraged about. It's kind of like your brain can't hold it all.
We live in interesting times, Peter.
Yeah, that's for sure.
which is all the more reason why it's important that we be knowledgeable and that we be active.
Right. Anyway, in regards to this whole professor outrage thing, this has been going on for a couple of weeks now. I remember seeing
Horowitz
a couple
has been
little clippings about it recently.
For a year now, actually.
Yeah, it's almost like they want to subsidize Republican education, you know. Oh man, these educated people, they're all liberals. That's no good. Gotta fix that.
Yeah.
Know?
How dare they study the Constitution?
Yeah, really.
We can't have that. We can't have that. So what do you, we've got 10 seconds, 20 seconds here left, Peter. What are you going to do about it?
Oh, that's a good question. Wish I was still in school. I could be a little more active in these things.
Well, may I encourage you to write a letter to the editor of your local newspaper.
Oh, absolutely.
To contact your elected officials and say that you believe in academic freedom and you would like to see the parties, both of them,
step out of,
keep their hands off the universities.
Absolutely. Great suggestion.
And for David Horowitz to get his nose out of this stuff. This guy is really doing some harm to our educational institutions, in my opinion. Peter, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. And tag your it. Pass it along. In fact, I say that to all of you. Tag your it! Now carry the message. Carry the message on.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. We were just speaking of the... Generally I don't carry a topic over from hour to hour, but... to wrap this, we were just talking about this bill before the Ohio Senate. They would make it illegal to teach in a university or college anything, quote, controversial, end quote, and put politicians, specifically the Republican Party, in charge of the curriculum of all colleges and universities in the state of Ohio. And thus we will end up with only Republican thinking.
You're free, and freedom is beautiful. And, you know, it'll take time to restore chaos.
Yes, it's a scary thought, isn't it? The brainchild of David Horowitz, himself, according to the Center for American Progress, a fellow who has no academic credentials whatsoever and routinely distorts facts, exactly the crime he accuses so-called liberal professors of committing to fit his political bias. Thinkprogress.org, you can share information about him. Horowitz claims his bill is necessary because college campuses are a hostile environment for conservatives, but as Americans Progress Ben Hubbard and David Halpern point out, increasingly it's the conservative movement that sets the agenda. And, you know, as I mentioned, over the last 30 years, a dozen right-wing institutions have now spent $38 million a year, each year, over 30 years, pushing right-wing agendas to college students, very often thinly disguised as educational materials. Horowitz's best attempt to prove liberal bias on campus is his Academic Freedom Abuse Center, housed on the Students for Academic Freedom website. He has this database, which invites students to report having their rights abused in class. And it looks like there's lots of stuff there. Boy, lots of students having their rights, their academic freedom rights abused, until you start reading it. One student complains because a professor suggested men and women might see colors differently. Another is offended because she was asked to watch an immoral Seinfeld episode. The latest entry in the database as of Tuesday afternoon was from an Ohio State student who claims he got a bad grade on an essay because his English professor, quotes, hates families and thinks it's okay to be gay, end quote. One of the complaints comes from an college senior who is upset her school, quote, used funds from student activity fees to bring in the one-sided speaker, David Horowitz. The guy who is promoting this bill that has been introduced into the State Senate of Ohio by Senator Larry Mumper, who says that 80% of college professors are Democrats, liberals, or socialists, or card-carrying communists, that will put the control of the teaching of, quote, controversial matter, end quote, under the control of whatever party happens to control the state of Ohio, in this case, at the moment, the Republican Party. Just what we need in America, isn't it? Just what we need. You know, more intellectual geniuses coming out of our colleges.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to call in and speak on this or any other topic. I also want to move along. We've got an interesting story here about a hospital who is trying to evict a patient. And what does this have to do with universal health care, middle-class families, and some interesting stats now on the death of the middle class in America. First, let's take a few phone calls. 1-866-889-8894. Rob in Pennsylvania. Rob Call of opednews.com, as I recall.
Yep.
Hey, Rob. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, you know, I've written at least a half a dozen articles on opednews.com talking about the need for the progressives to have the counterpart to the right wing's policy promotion organizations. They call them think tanks, and they spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year on these. And we don't have the money. We have basically one that is, has any serious funding, the Center for American Progress, John Podesta's group.
Yeah.
But I got a call, yesterday from somebody at Tufts University, a student there, who's trying to put together something on campus. And it, and he asked me some basic questions about this. And I think it could be a brilliant plan for progressive students to get going, putting together something like a progressive promotion policy promotion think tank on campuses.
So how do they do it, Rob? How do they do it?
I think that the first thing, one of the main things is the universities have incredible resources. One of the great strengths of these right-wing think tanks is they have media facilities where their talking heads can get access to the kind of equipment you need to be able to work with CNN or Fox or whatever so that they can get integrated into the news. And a lot of the universities, I think, have those facilities.
Right.
So,
well, not only that, you have extraordinary AV facilities within, or communications facilities within universities. For example, I gave a talk at a university, I don't know, 3 months ago or so out west, and it was, I was in one of the lecture halls, but they were also videotaping the thing, and, you know, so that it could be used for other purposes. And
exactly,
they were broadcasting it in another building on another campus that was affiliated with this university that was about 400 miles away.
Right, and that might cost millions of dollars to put together. So you don't have to start by spending that money if you're working through a university as a student organization.
Right.
And you can take that and then get some really strong advisory people, the top people in the university, in your town, because you're offering them access to the technology that will get them, make them a lot more accessible to the mainstream media.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you could really, even though you're just a student organization, have incredible advisors. That you should go for the best people in your town, in your university, and invite them to be on the advisory board and to be your talking heads.
Yeah, and take on the politics and the issues of the day, and try to present honestly both sides of an issue so that people actually can understand them. Rather, I think one of the things where the right-wing think tanks have been so disingenuous is they rather than trying to say, for example, with Social Security, rather than saying that they think that this Social Security is socialism, that it's the slippery slope down the road to communism, that government has no right providing social safety nets, which is the historic conservative viewpoint, and Republicans in the 1930s and 1940s in Congress were perfectly willing and in fact proud to say so, you know, out loud. Instead of saying that, now they say, oh, no, we have to fix it. And, of course, the fix is a way that, you know, with a wink and a nod, all the other Republicans know it's privatizing it. It's doing away with a government system and replacing it with the corporate system, basically.
Well, the main thing that these right-wing policy promotion organizations do is they develop ways of presenting their policies to the public in a way that hits all their hot buttons, that taps archetypes and mythic elements, that uses the language that Lakoff talks about in Don't Think of an Elephant.
Yeah.
And anybody who's working in a think tank needs to read Lakoff's book and Don't Think of an Elephant, and even better, his more comprehensive book, Moral Politics. And because you want to make sure that when you're taking up an issue, that you're not using the right-wing language and literally using their memes, their toxic memes, and helping them. You
right.
want to create your own language that frames things for your benefit so that you, when you talk about it, you can explain the way that they use their language right. to distort and twist things. Then you wanted to put it in your way. The other thing you need to do is you got to remember you can't do it all. You got to identify who you want to influence and start out local, but keep in mind that you may want to be creating a model that can be adopted nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't have to take that many of these. If they do that, then everybody can start adopting it.
Yeah, and it can literally start with one or two students. I mean, it literally can start with one or two students. There is somebody listening to this program right now who could begin this.
And
I encourage you to do so, whoever you may be.
And there's somebody else listening who could help fund it.
Well, but the point is that, as you pointed out at the very beginning, Rob, universities have tremendous resources available to students for student activities, and it may not need any funding. I mean, you know, or it may need very little funding. You simply make use of the university facilities. Say, hey, you know, we'll create a campus club, And we would like to have access to a lecture hall. We would like to have access to AV equipment. I mean, universities have this stuff. It's available.
These
billions
are the benefits of dollars worth of it.
Yeah, these are the benefits of being a student in a university, is that you do have access to these things.
So there are characteristics to these policy promotion organizations. I've written a lot about it on opednews.com, and if people want to get started with an idea of thinking about it, they can go there, go to that section from the sitemap,
yeah,
and they'll be able to get a good starter reading. And I'm putting together another article now that'll be out in the next day or two on how to get started.
It's great. Good on you, Rob. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, and I think it's wonderful what you're doing. Dave in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I so much appreciate you digging up some of the stuff that you do. I don't find it any other place most of the time. If what you're saying this morning, if I'm hearing you right, they want to make laws in Ohio that,
yeah,
they can only teach that which, in effect, the GOP approves of them?
Well, that any quote, controversial material, end quote, this is a phrase in the law, any controversial material cannot be taught on college campus without the approval of the legislature or the court system, which in the case of the state of Ohio are run by the Republican Party.
You know, these same folks are trying to make exit polling illegal. They're trying to make it illegal to modify these voting machines. You know,
yeah, what a surprise.
It troubles me immensely to hear people, good people, intelligent people, you just had a couple there, that really believe that they can get out there and appeal to more Democratic voters. I am convinced how people vote on these voting machines has got nothing to do with how the elections are going to turn out.
Well, and I think Hillary Clinton and Barbara Boxer are convinced of that, and that's why today they introduced this piece of legislation
and nowhere
into
will
the
you
Senate.
Find that on the news except in your program. I did find it on their site here, and also Stephanie Tubbs-Jones is a part of it, too.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, but I was amazed when you know, I heard about this. Somebody sent me an email about this morning, and it was actually a copy of an email that Hillary Clinton sent out, you know, to her supporters.
Yeah.
And so I went into the Google News and did a search. And first of all, I searched the New York Times. I figured it would be on the front page. I couldn't find it in their archives. I went to Washington Post, couldn't find it. So I went to Google News, couldn't find it, and ended up having to go to clinton.senate.gov and do a search within that to find this thing. And this is like, this should be major national news, that two United States senators are introducing legislation to the Count Every Vote Act to require that voting machines produce a paper trail that our vote actually have some integrity to it.
We are witnessing the most extreme takeover in any government ever that I can think of.
Well, it's not just the government. I mean, the media is right in the middle of this thing, and it concerns me terribly, Dave. Because
yes, stay with your good efforts.
And you too. You too. You keep passing the word along, Dave. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Oh, my. The Tom Hartman Program, where reason and passion go together like love and marriage or Republican presidents and gay hookers. Hi.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
They tell us the president the same way. They sell us our clothes and our cars. They sell us everything from youth to religion. Same time they sell us our wars. I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance. There are people on the fire.
Why there is blood on the wire. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. U.S. Senators Hillary Rodham Clinton and Barbara Boxer. You can find this at clinton.senate.gov, G-O-V. Presumably also at boxer.senate.gov. I haven't looked there yet to check, but you can find a link to it. U.S. Senators Hillary Rodham Clinton and Barbara Boxer today unveiled comprehensive voting reform legislation. Now, why would this be important? Well, here we have Steve Freeman and Josh Middledorf have published this paper. It's published in These Times, by the way, one of the sponsors of this program, and a marvelous progressive publication. And they say, although President Bush prevailed by 3 million votes in the official tallied vote count, exit polls had projected a margin of victory of 5 million votes for John Kerry. This unexplained 8 million vote discrepancy between the election night exit polls and the official count should raise a Chinese May Day of red flags. The discrepancy, according to the Edison-Matovsky folks, the folks who did the exit polls, they tried to explain it away. They said the discrepancy was, quote, most likely due to Kerry voters participating in the exit polls at a higher rate than Bush voters, end quote. But the body of the report offers no data to substantiate this position. In fact, data presented in the report served to rebut the thesis and bolster suspicions that the official vote count was way, way off. In other words, these guys, they're academics. They write like academics. God bless them. In other words, the election, according to the information that the exit poll folks themselves put out, the election was stolen. Are you with me on this? I'm not wearing a tinfoil hat. I'm really not. I am reading to you from an article written by university professors. It must be liberals. That must be it. No, I think not. Professional statisticians. The overall margin of error should have been under 1%, but the official results deviated from the poll projections by more than 5%, a statistical impossibility. They say the Matovsky and Edison say, quote, precincts with touchscreen and optical voting have essentially the same error rates as those using punch card systems. That's true. However, all that means is that all three of these systems may have been corrupted. Hacked. Broken into. Notably, they say, Matovsky and Edison unsuccessfully try to explain away the fact that according to their data, this is according to the exit pollers' data, only in precincts that used old-fashioned, hand-counted paper ballots did the official count and the exit polls fall within the normal sampling margin of error. Now, why is that not a headline on the New York Times? Why is that not the lead tonight with Dan Rather? Or Peter Jennings? Or even, Brian Williams, he says he thinks it's part of his job, it's his duty to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day. So further data that are underplayed in the report provide support for the hypothesis that the election was stolen. I'm quoting from professional statisticians here. The discrepancy between the exit polls and the official count was considerably greater in the critical swing state. They say this, if fraud was afoot, it would make sense that the president's men would steal votes in their strongholds, where the likelihood of detection was small. Lo and behold, the report provides data that strongly bolster this theory. In those precincts that went at least 80% for Bush, the average error within precinct was a whopping 10.0. In contrast, in Kerry strongholds, the exit polls matched the official count almost exactly. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Watch out for me, woman, and don't mind nobody else. Watch out for me, woman, and don't mind nobody else.
Yeah, look out for Hillary and Barbara. Hillary Clinton and Barbara Boxton. Where are the Republicans on this? I mean, what if the Democrats got a hold of this thing? We have this affidavit from Clinton Curtis, I believe his name is, saying that Congressman Feeney down in Florida hired him to write a hack for voting machines. Feeney telling him that he did it to find out if it was possible so that it could be prevented. A way of hacking into voting machines or reprogramming them so that, say, every 10th vote would flip to the other party and would be undetectable. Curtis, he, in his sworn affidavit, provided to Congress under penalty of felony perjury. Swears that Congressman Feeney took possession of this. And, you know, it's a pretty serious charge. Feeney refuses to discuss it. Again, where's the media on this? Feeney, a Republican. Do you think that if a Democrat was the chairman of Diebold and a Democrat had said, I'm going to bring home the vote for John Kerry this year. Help me out. Yeah, I am committed to bringing Ohio to John Kerry. And he was the chairman of the voting machine company that was based in that state and whose machines were being used in that state. Not exclusively, but exclusively in some other states. And was advocating for the voting machines having no paper trail whatsoever. And that John Kerry won. And that the exit polls showed that he should have lost by 5 million votes and instead he won by 3 million votes. Do you think that there might be a little bit of a stink? I'm just, you know, what surprises me is that there aren't Republicans out there. And I know there's a few. I know, you know, like Ron Paul. I know that there's a few Republicans actually who are very concerned about this. But what surprises me is that there aren't more Republicans out there who are saying, you know, if we can hack these machines, Democrats can too. We got to do something about this. I mean, you know, their hackers might be better than ours someday. Because I don't think that the voting machine companies themselves have anything to do with hacking the machines. That's too much of a conspiracy theory for me. Sorry. I see this more like the mafia, you know. It's like, you know, local guys, they know what to do. You know, we take care of our own here in this county. We're gonna do whatever it takes to get our guy elected. It shouldn't surprise you. I mean, the Democratic Party did it for years in the South. So, gee, the Republicans are doing it now? Could it be? Who knows? I don't know. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. John in Shreveport. John, you love to call me and essentially bait me with some sort of weird question. Why don't you just make your point this time?
Well, no, because, see, what I like to do is I like to ask you a question, and I like to get your response, because what I do is I keep a log of all this.
I see.
Okay. Now, see, just because...
John, have you ever spoken to a psychologist about obsessive-compulsive disorder?
Have you ever spoken to a psychologist about telling the truth? Okay, here's my question to you. Okay.
John, have you ever spoken to a psychotherapist about obsessive-compulsive disorder?
Have you ever spoken... at a trial and been told that, by the way, that perjury is a felony. It's never a misdemeanor.
Yeah, that was my understanding.
You
yeah.
said that felony perjury, not misdemeanor perjury. There's no such thing as misdemeanor perjury.
Okay.
Question to you real quick.
Sure.
Why do you think Iran is developing nuclear power? Is it for peaceful purposes or otherwise, and why?
Well, just to be totally candid and just straight up here, you know, I'm assuming that you're trying to play gotcha here, but nonetheless, I'll just tell you what I think. I think that there's two things going on. One is they're sitting on a pile of oil, and, you know, we had a lot of oil here in the northeastern United States.
I'm from Louisiana. I know about oil.
Okay, and it's all gone.
No, not here. They're drilling oil on my father's property.
Oh, I know. But up here in the Northeast, it's all gone. Standard Oil of Ohio used to be, because there was oil in Ohio. Pennzoil used to be Pennsylvania oil. John Rockefeller made his fortune drilling oil in the Northeast, and it's all gone. You're sitting on a pile of oil, and you know that it's a 20-year supply, 15-year supply, a 30-year supply, whatever. You know it's not going to be a 100-year supply. Number one, you might want to have a policy of developing alternative energy sources. That's a possibility. Number two, you've got a country that has named you as part of the axis of evil and has shown that they will attack countries that don't have nuclear weapons, like Iran, but they won't attack countries that do have nuclear weapons, like North Korea. Mm-hmm. And that might cause you to think, you know, gee, maybe I better get a weapon. Mm-hmm. So, which is the mutual assured destruction insanity. It's a general insanity.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't surprise me that there's a good element of both in their thinking, frankly.
Okay. Well, so now, see, that was reasonable, that was fair, and it's even kind of what I expected from you. So I thank you for your time and taking
the
call.
I'm curious, John. Does it make sense to you?
Sure does. I mean, but see, I want to hear your version of it. Now, I find it interesting when you and I have the same versions of facts, or at least opinions.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Margie, and I was waiting for him to ask me if a psychotherapist had ever asked me about upset, because I actually am one, or was one in another business lifetime. Margie in Southern Oregon on the line. Hey, Margie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm so grateful that we get to hear you on the South Coast. We hear you from the Eureka, California station.
Yes, on KGOE, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yes, wonderful.
And I wanted to write down the bill number, that Ohio State Republican bill number.
Yeah.
Do you
yeah.
have that?
I believe I do. Let's see here. It is Senate Bill 24 in the state of Ohio.
And is there a number to write down regarding the Boxer-Clinton Act?
Let me see on that. I don't see a. I think it was introduced today, and I think they assign a number to it after it's been introduced. So I see a number on it. She's calling it the Count Every Vote Act.
Right. Okay.
And if you just go to clinton.senate.gov, it's you know, there's a link to it right there. So. And, of course, here's the phone number for the United States Congress, which gets you both the House and the Senate. And you could just call and ask for Barbara Boxer's office or Senator Clinton's office. Any Senate or your member of Congress or whatever, the number is area code 202-224-3121. That's the main switchboard. In fact, they'll even transfer you to the White House. That's the main switchboard for Congress and everything there in Washington, D.C., 202-224-3121.
Thank you. And I just wanted to mention I'm reading for the first time 1984, and boy, is it scary.
It's a grim book, isn't it? You know, I was in Australia 4 years ago, 5 years ago, doing a speaking tour of four or five cities, and I took that with me as airplane reading. And the combination of jet lag, you know, you just sleep in a real funky way when you're 12 hours off. And the combination of the jet lag and that book was producing such frightening nightmares I was having. I mean, which I don't normally have. I don't think I've had a serious nightmare since I was a little kid. But I was having just these horrible, horrible dreams that I had to stop reading it. You know, I just wait until I I'd read it, you know, when I was a teenager. But, you know, because I had to read it in high school. But I was halfway through it, and it's so dark, and I think what was so frightening about it is that so much of what I was reading back when I read it as a teenager, I was thinking this will never happen here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm reading it now, or you know, a couple of years ago, it was like they've already done this stuff. You know?
Well, with the date today, and with the reign of King George, this stuff is looking more real every day.
Yeah, and this is our third George, by the way. You know, we had George.
Is he the third?
Yeah, we had George Washington, we had George Bush the first, and we now have George Bush the second. So this is the third George to rule the United States. Just like once the U.S. took on the third George to rule England, isn't that an interesting irony?
Yes.
For all of those out there interested in numbers and things. Margie, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And good luck in contacting your elected officials. I assume that's what you're up to.
Yes.
And I congratulate you on it. Thank you.
Thank you for your work.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'll keep at it. You too. You as well.
Okay.
Okay. 1-866-889-8894. Elaine in Humboldt County, presumably also listening on KGOE. Hey, Elaine.
That's right. KGOE.
One of my favorite radio stations. Tom Seaborn, one of the finest program directors out there.
Well, I've had very good success with them. They're always pleasant when you call, and they try to take action.
Yeah, they're good people.
I was just wondering, with our Bush administration, who appointed them the keeper of the world?
Yeah.
I mean, he's out there.
That's a question the world is wondering, too, Margie, or Elaine.
Doing all these things, bringing democracy. I thought it was an adage in this country to clean off your own doorstep first.
Yeah, well, in fact, you know, in the Beatitudes, in the Sermon on the Mount, after the Beatitudes, in the Sermon on the Mount, in the eighth chapter, as I recall, of Matthew, Jesus even suggests that, you know, take the beam out of your own eye before you try and take the speck of dust out of your neighbor's.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And what makes him think these people want democracy?
Well, there will be some among them who do. And there is a reality, Elaine. There is a very real reality to the idea. And in fact, I write about it in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? To the idea that governments that are democratically elected do not go to war with each other. And the reason why is because their people don't, you know, will never vote to go to war. There has in the roughly 200 year history, more or less, really 130.
But don't they also wait until they're attacked before they go in and do what he has done in Iraq?
That's exactly right. We now, this is an example of a democracy going to war against a non-democracy. So it still hasn't violated the rule. But the rule basically is that democracies never go to war against each other, and it's never happened, and at least overtly. And so the theory, and that being the case, and there's actually several books that have been written about this that lay this out. That being the case, these neocons have taken this to the level of a religion. It's become an evangelical religion of spreading democracy.
Doesn't make it right.
Not only does it not make it right, it doesn't make it useful because democracy is something that you can't impose on people. I remember one time Dick Gregory and I were flying over to Africa. It was in 1981. We started a hospital in Africa in 1980 during the war with Idi Amin when the Tanzanians came in and ran him out. It started out actually as a refugee center for starving people. And it is now still operating as a hospital and a community for AIDS orphans. And anyhow, we were flying over there together, and he was going to help us raise some money for it, get us some publicity. And we're on the airplane. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and we're just all jazzed up. And we've had a couple glasses of wine. And he says, you know what I don't understand? I'm not going to try and imitate his accent, but he says, you know what I don't understand about American foreign policy? I says, what's that? And we were talking about Vietnam. He says, I don't understand why Americans think we can run around the world trying to shove our way of life down the throat of other people with a barrel of a gun. He says, when you've got something good, you don't have to force it on people.
That's right.
He says, they will steal it. You know, and that's the thing. You know, you don't have to force it on people. They will steal it. There was a huge pro-democracy movement in Iran, and it was right up against the edge about 2 years ago of toppling the mullahs. And the CIA was reporting on this, that, you know, there's this huge tension inside Iran, that the mullahs are essentially holding this kind of Supreme Court position, that they can cancel laws that are passed. And all these democratic laws are being passed, and there's a huge democracy movement within Iran. As soon as George Bush labeled Iran as part of the axis of evil, all of a sudden the democracy movement came under attack within Iran and started to shrink. People started walking away from it. They didn't want to be associated. It became very dangerous. We're harming democracy by being evangelical about it. You can't force democracy
down. This man talks out of both sides of his mouth. I read in the Progressive that he's supporting the dictator in Uzbekistan. And out of all their political prisoners, 6,500 estimated, that this dictator even boiled two of them to death.
Yeah, well, and
he's supporting that.
And Musharraf in Pakistan, and I mean, you know, the list, and the Saudi royal family, you know, which every Friday afternoon in the soccer stadium, they have the public beheadings in Riyadh. The Saudi royal family is the largest lifetime patron of the Bush family. Over $1 billion over the years have gone from the Saudi royal family and the Bin Laden family into the Bush family or businesses associated with the Bush family. And, and every Friday they have public executions where they chop people's heads off. And we wonder why they think chopping heads off is like a normal thing to do in the Middle East. And so anyhow, you got me going there.
This man, I don't know, Reagan did away with our mental hospitals almost in California and turned everybody out on the street.
Right, producing an epidemic of homelessness.
Yeah, and I think that we need a new arrangement, and I think Bush should be the first one admitted.
Okay.
And Cheney second.
All right. The problem is we got to have somebody in line beyond Denny Hester, you know.
Right,
Elaine, thanks for the call. It's great to hear
from
you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Raymond in Cement City, Michigan on the line. Hey, Raymond, what's up?
Hey, Tom, look, I wanted to bring up a third item to the list that you presented to that caller.
About why Iran might be developing a nuclear weapon?
Yeah, I think that it's good trading material for open access to markets to be in the community of nations with Europe. They're,
yeah,
they're
it makes them
need.
A player. I mean, it worked well for Pakistan.
Yeah, and it's, there's two sides to that. From the Iranian standpoint, it really gives them the economic connections they need to grow. But also, from the European standpoint, and this would be a European worldview, is this part of being the peacemaker. If we are our inner communicating
yeah.
with each other, we're no, independent, it's we won't go to war.
Yeah, it's a good point, Raymond. It makes them big shots, and I think that's an important one, and it's an important one to say that, you know, that Israel did it, Pakistan did it, India did it. It makes them big shots, and that's... Good point. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
You're gonna break another heart. You're gonna tell another lie.
Oh, George, please don't.
Well, here I am, and there you go, you're gone again. I know you're gonna be the way you've always been.
Oh, George, please
Breaking
don't.
Breaking hearts and telling lies is all you know. Another guy gives you the eye, and there you go.
Oh, he's not talking about George. He's talking about the phony journalist there, Jeff. Anyway, welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894 telephone number. Oh, it's actually pretty late in the show here for any more phone calls, I suppose. But let me just wrap this thing up on the voting machines. You will recall a week or two ago when Matovsky and Edison came out with their explanation for why the exit polls showed that John Kerry won the election by 5 million votes, but the electronic voting machines showed that George Bush won the election by 3 million votes, and exclusively the places that used electronic voting machines, those places where the ballots were hand-counted, there was no discrepancy. You will recall that Matovsky Edison said the reason for this was that they had hired young, inexperienced people to ask the questions of the voters as they exited the polls, and the Republicans tended to be older, more conservative folks, and they were less likely to talk to these young folks. Well, it turns out, you look at the Matovsky-Edison statistics. In fact, the data suggests that Bush voters were slightly more likely to complete the survey. 56% of voters completed the survey in the Bush strongholds compared to 53% in the Kerry strongholds. So actually, the exit polls, apparently, when they showed that Kerry won by 5 million votes and that Bush lost by 3 million votes, that Kerry won by 5 million votes, they apparently underestimated how many votes Kerry got, the exit polls. Again, Steve Freeman and Josh Middledorf, they wrap this thing up. They say the exit polls themselves are a strong indicator of a corrupted election. Moreover, the exit poll discrepancies must be interpreted in the context of more than 100,000 officially logged reports of irregularities during Election Day 2004. For many Americans, if not most, mass-scale fraud in a U.S. presidential election is an unthinkable possibility. But taken together, the allegations, the substantially documented irregularities, systematic vulnerabilities, and implausible numbers suggest a coherent story of fraud and deceit. And that doesn't tell the whole story. The exit poll numbers doesn't count the voters who were disenfranchised before they got to the polls, the voting machine shortages in Democratic districts, fraudulent felony purges, and the voter rolls still going on in the state of Florida. We know it happened in Ohio this time. The barriers to registration, the unmailed, lost, or rejected absentee ballots. The exit polls didn't measure any of that stuff. Isn't it amazing? that here we're discussing the possibility that an election was stolen. I mean, solid, hard-nosed scientists looking at this thing. And a couple of members of the United States Senate introducing legislation to prevent it from happening again. And maybe, I don't know, 3 hours later, maybe it's there's a story about it out there, but there wasn't when I started this program in the mainstream media. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.